It's time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, April 5th, 2024. I'm Dave Busick. My partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Scott Splavik. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. In this first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today, and then our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news, and we'll wrap up, as usual, with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Let's take a look at the weather for this spring day. Starting out awfully chilly, around 30 degrees here in Des Moines when I got up this morning. Iowa is in for a bit of a weather roller coaster over the next few days. The Weather Service says Friday, today, will be generally pleasant, although a little cool, with northeast breezes near 10 miles an hour, mostly sunny skies, and highs in the 50s. On Saturday, mostly sunny skies will prevail again, and temperatures will rise into the upper 50s to lower 60s, but strong and gusty southeast winds will put a damper on outdoor activities and will also promote an elevated fire risk. Showers and storms will then move in late Saturday into Saturday night, persisting on and off throughout Sunday. Monday will see lingering light rain chances in the north and partly to mostly cloudy skies, potentially impacting eclipse viewing conditions in parts of the state. Here's the specific day part forecast for Des Moines and central Iowa. Mostly sunny today, high 58, winds out of the northeast at 5 to 10. Pretty pleasant day. Tonight, a few clouds, low 34. Then Saturday, mostly sunny and windy, dry until Saturday night. The high tomorrow will be 61 degrees, but winds out of the southeast to 20 to 30 miles an hour with gusts up to 40 miles an hour. Saturday night, increasing clouds and showers likely overnight. A thunderstorm possible as well, low down to 43. Sunday, rain likely in the morning, then showers possible throughout the day. Mostly cloudy, high 64, east winds at 15 to 20 with gusts up to 30. Sunday night, chance of still more showers, otherwise partly to mostly cloudy, low 45. And then on Monday, partly sunny skies, a high around 61, winds out of the west at 10 to 20 miles an hour. So good morning, Scott. Let's take a look at the front page of today's Des Moines Register.
Morning, Dave. Our headlines on the front page of the Register today include Medicaid for Moms extension passes, mind-blowing how Iowa women's basketball impacted a fan base and a state, and congregation belatedly celebrates 150 years of community. And I'll start with the article, Medicaid for Moms extension passes, but measure would end coverage for some. It's written by Galen Bacarier of the Des Moines Register. Legislation granting low-income Iowa mothers a full year of Medicaid coverage after giving birth and ending coverage for others is heading to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for her signature. The bill, which lowers the income threshold to qualify for coverage and will cut off coverage to an estimated 1,700 women and babies each month, received final approval from the House on Wednesday. Senate File 2251 was passed on a 70-25 vote, with some Democrats in opposition. Reynolds proposed the measure during her annual address in January. Current Iowa law provides new mothers with Medicaid coverage during pregnancy and for 60 days after giving birth, the minimum length of time under federal law. If signed by Reynolds, Iowa will join almost every U.S. state in implementing a 12-month extension on that coverage. This bill is imperative for those moms that need it most, said Representative Devin Wood, a Republican from New Market. Under the bill, the maximum family income to be eligible for postpartum Medicaid coverage in Iowa is reduced. Currently, new mothers with a maximum family income of 375% of the federal poverty level, about $117,000 for a family of four, are eligible for coverage in Iowa. Reynolds' plan lowers that income ceiling for postpartum coverage to 215% of the federal poverty level, about $64,500 annually for a family of four. An analysis of the bill by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency determined that the eligibility restrictions would lead to about 1,300 women and 400 babies losing coverage each month. The eligibility changes have been criticized by Democrats who have supported extending coverage but oppose removing Iowans from Medicaid rolls. 215% feels arbitrary to me, and it feels unnecessarily low, said Representative Heather Mattson, a Democrat from Ankeny, of the new income threshold. Opponents have cited Iowa's rising maternal mortality rate as evidence that coverage is still necessary for those with higher income. It's not an expensive endeavor, and the cost is so high for not doing it, House Minority Leader Jennifer Converse, a Democrat from Windsor Heights, said. An attempt by Democrats to amend the bill to retain the current 375% income threshold was defeated on party lines. Wood, the bill's sponsor, defended it as addressing the most vulnerable mothers in Iowa and said their coverage remained more generous than in several neighboring states. This is a step that is an essential puzzle piece to the programs we've done in the last couple of years, Wood said. Also heading to Reynolds' desk is a series of tweaks to her More Options for Maternal Support, or MOMS, program. The program sends state dollars to pregnancy resource centers that counsel women against abortion, offer donated items for new mothers, and conduct family planning classes and other programs. Under the changes approved by lawmakers in Senate File 2252, the state would no longer be required to hire a third-party administrator to oversee the program, instead allowing the Department of Health and Human Services to take on that role. The department has overseen the program on an interim basis as the state failed twice last year to identify a qualified entity to serve as administrator. Any administrator hired would no longer need 3 years of experience in Iowa to be hired, a previous requirement repealed under the changes. Representative Michael Bergen, a Republican from Dorchester, said he had full confidence in the department to oversee the program and praised the pregnancy resource centers. These entities provide necessary safety nets to women in need who want to bring their child into the world, Bergen said. Democrats opposed the bill, questioning the MOMS program's efficacy after the state's failure to find an outside administrator and questioning the veracity of clinics involved with the program. I see the failure to find a substitute administrator as a time when we should reflect on the viability of the program that will send taxpayer dollars to pregnancy resource centers, Mattson said. Mattson said she had seen one such clinic promoting abortion pill reversal services, arguing that the state shouldn't send money to an organization that promotes medically dangerous information as part of their pregnancy support services. Bergen said the department would take efforts to establish standards of care across clinics that receive state support. And Representative Brad Sherman, a Republican from Williamsburg, defended the qualifications of those employed by one such clinic, of which he was previously a co-founder. I'm proud of the work we did at Informed Choice of Iowa, and it continues today, and I just feel like that needed to be correct, Sherman said. The legislation passed the House 61-34. And a little side note here, Stephen Gruber Miller contributed to the reporting of this article.
And the story across the bottom of the front page in today's Register, headline, Congregation belatedly celebrates 150 years of community. The story by Kyle Werner of the Register. Members of Temple B'nai Jeshurun, which in 1873 became the first established Jewish congregation in Des Moines, had already been worshiping together for more than a half century when leaders began planning a new temple for their home. They envisioned a handsome white stone edifice with room for religious and community gatherings, according to a Register report from October 23, 1930. The regal building that stands at 5101 Grand Avenue on Des Moines' west side opened in 1932 and still serves as the home for Iowa's first Reform congregation, a more progressive branch of the Jewish faith. That congregation has now reached the milestone of 150 years and remains a historic pillar of the Jewish community in Des Moines and Iowa. Throughout that century and a half, in times of joy and sorrow, the focus has remained on community, its leaders say. The temple's anniversary comes amid heightened security measures as the Israel-Hamas war rages on. Temple leaders were forced to push back their original celebration because of the brutal October 7th Hamas attack on Israeli towns that killed at least 1,200 people. Today, the temple keeps its doors locked for safety as calls for an Israeli ceasefire in Gaza grow and Jewish people across the country report a rise in anti-Semitic attacks. Nonetheless, leaders are commemorating the milestone and the temple's impact on its members, Metro Des Moines, and the state with events that continue in upcoming months. The temple's 150th anniversary committee said in a statement to the Des Moines Register, quote, "We've had 150 years of baby namings, b'nai mitzvah, confirmations, weddings, meals of consolation, programs, and celebrations shared as a community that remains vibrant today." The temple was run out of a rented hall until its members bought and converted a building off of 7th and Mulberry Streets. The congregation later erected its first temple at the southwest corner of 8th and Pleasant Streets until growing membership prompted the decision to build on the Grand Avenue site. Today, Temple B'nai Jeshurun holds Shabbat services on Friday nights and Saturday mornings that brings the Jewish community together. Every first Friday of the month, Rabbi Neil Schuster, who has been the rabbi at Temple B'nai Jeshurun since 2022, leads family Shabbat services, which include a prayer book oriented toward children. There are also special Shabbat services throughout the year designed for families with young children, such as Zoo Shabbat at Blank Park Zoo and a pet Shabbat service. Additionally, services are held for other Jewish holidays, including Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchat Torah, Hanukkah, and Purim. On February 24th, Temple B'nai Jeshurun officially celebrated 150 years with a night of connecting with old and new friends and being together for Shabbat. More than 150 people shared a silent auction, music, food, and camaraderie. Rabbi Schuster said, "The number of people who turned up from all across the community and just had a wonderful evening of being together and everything, it was really nice. It was a lot of fun. It was very, very meaningful." Originally scheduled for last November 4th, the temple rescheduled the 150th celebration after the October 7th attack, said Emily Cruz, board president at the temple, because it was not the appropriate time for that kind of celebration. For Rabbi Schuster, the celebration could not be had without the recognition of the strength of the Jewish people and what they have been through. He said, "We have this expression in Hebrew, Gamze Ya'avor, meaning this too shall pass. But this shall not pass by being passive and waiting, but by working hard to return to times of joy, strength, and celebration," he said. Emily Cruz described the event as a great success and a chance to recognize the history and the fact that we've been here for so long and are still here and plan to continue to be here. The temple also plans to hold monthly food drives and tailor its regular services to the 150th anniversary. It also held a community pancake breakfast in August and celebrated Hanukkah last year by bringing in 150 dreidels to spin all at once. Cruz said, "All funds raised at special events throughout the year will go to the temple's endowment to ensure our next 150 years. As a result," she said, "we will remain a strong, vital hub of Jewish life in central Iowa." More events celebrating Temple B'nai Jeshurun's 150th anniversary will be announced on the temple's Facebook page. Emily Cruz, the board president, said, "Really, our main goal when talking about events for the year was we want people to come together. We as a community like to be together. We like being with each other." According to the temple's website, the temple still holds to the goals of its founders, quote, "to maintain a synagogue as a center of worship, religious education, and communal gathering, to foster a living Judaism, not only in the temple, but also in the homes and lives of its members and their families, and to adjust the teachings and practices of old to the needs of each new generation of American Jews." In 2016, the temple made space for the Orthodox Beth El Jacob congregation when that congregation made the difficult decision to close due to declining membership. Now, just four synagogues are active in central Iowa, including one in Ames, according to the Jewish Federation of Des Moines. Rabbi Schuster said, there's this invigorating sense of it's only our first 150 years, and we've been here since the earliest days. We're here now in this exciting time for the city of Des Moines. Emily Cruz said, I think there are some people in Des Moines that would be surprised to know that there's a Jewish community here in town. We're all your friends and neighbors. That sounds so cheesy, but like, you know, we're here. We have kids that go to school with your kids. We are involved in the community.
Thank you, Dave. Our final story from the front page of the Register today, mind-blowing, how Iowa women's basketball impacted a fan base and a state. It's written by Chad Leistikow of the Des Moines Register. The dateline is Cleveland. The text messages lit up my cell phone Monday night after Iowa's 94-87 victory against LSU in the most watched game in women's basketball history with 12.3 million viewers on ESPN. Excited friends, most of them native Iowans who have been Hawkeye sports fans for more than four decades, were asking something similar to this. Did we just experience the greatest win in Hawkeye history? On the surface, to me, the premise felt a little bit of a stretch. Did we already forget that just last year the Iowa women stopped unbeaten South Carolina and its 42-game win streak to reach the NCAA championship game? What about number one Iowa's 12-10 win over number two Michigan football in 1985? The first home basketball game after Chris Street's tragic 1993 death, played against Michigan's Fab Five? And what about Steve Waite's three-point play to send the Iowa men's basketball team past Georgetown and into the 1980 Final Four? But as one friend noted, it's a conversation. So, one of the best parts of my job is hearing from people in my text message group, which is free for Des Moines Register or Hawkeye Central subscribers. Almost everyone in the group is deeply devoted Hawkeye fans, and most seem just fine keeping their distance from social media. So, I ask them to give me their thoughts on the matter. I don't know their names, just their numbers, and I encourage those who remember the 1980 Final Four well in particular to weigh in. And wow, the responses were overwhelming. They came in by the hundreds. Many brought tears to my eyes and began to shift my perspective. Maybe they'll impact yours too. Note, some responses are lightly edited for accuracy, clarity, and Register style. A team that has resonated with long-suffering Hawkeye fans. Hawkeye fans have plenty of past scar tissue. Even after that 1980 Georgetown win, Ronnie Lester's knee injury at the Final Four doomed the Hawkeyes' underdog shot at a national title. Tom Davis's 1987 men's team had a 16-point halftime lead in the Elite Eight against UNLV, but infamously unraveled. Football's 2015 Big Ten championship game against Michigan State turned fourth-quarter euphoria into heartache. So, to see superstar Caitlin Clark and coach Lisa Bluter's Hawkeyes not only excel in the brightest moments last year, but to meet enormous expectations this year has been a new and rewarding experience. No comparison, 1980 and last year were not as expected. This year, with all the expectations and pressure, was even more pleasing, one 68-year-old said. My wife has watched more basketball in the last couple of years with me than we have watched over the previous 40 total. That is saying something. One fan watched with great joy next to his 4 and 6-year-old sons Monday night, calling it surreal. I was their age watching Iowa fall to UNLV in 1987. It was the first time I cried and felt that emotional emptiness one suffers after meaningful losses, he said. But I imagined we would be back again the next year. Almost 40 years later, it made me so happy for my boys to see Iowa get over the hump and finish with the win. That's what is so amazing about this team. Another fan who was 18 years old during the 1980 Final Four run explained why this Hawkeye women's run has vaulted to number one. My reasoning is that the Hawkeyes have been a national story all year, and every game they have played, they have had a huge target on their back, the fan said. Even so, they have risen to the occasion time and time again. I don't remember another sporting event where the Hawkeyes were at the top or near the top of a sport, played a big game, and played up to and possibly even exceeded expectations. And, I might add, did it with total class in a very charged, difficult environment. The sustained success for Iowa over the last 2 years, with a 64-win, 11-loss record in that time, and beating the team that beat the Hawkeyes in last year's national title game, left no doubt for another fan. It was back-to-back Final Fours on the back of Caitlin Clark to cement it as Iowa's biggest basketball win, the fan said. It avenged a loss in the national spotlight. I don't think there's anything to debate. Another fan, who was 23 years old during the 1980 Final Four, still has the Register's Big Peach sports sections from that time. But they were not able to find the magic and repeat the following year, or any year since, the fan said. To work your way through an entire season, conference tournament, and March Madness 2 years in a row is just mind-blowing. Coach Lisa Bluder has demonstrated that you can attract and retain top talent at Iowa. She has painted a vision that the entire team has bought into. They are united in a way that really happens and rarely happens in sports. They have a real opportunity to win it all. The conversation goes from that win to this team. So many folks felt that this particular team getting this big win against LSU is what launched it into best ever status. One father explained how it's been refreshing to see Iowa reach a national stage like this and not be a total underdog. We have a seat at the table and can compete with anyone, he said. I know this won't be a regular occurrence, so the experience from these last 2 years has been memory-making. This Iowa team has created family time, where we are all in the same place and enjoying the same thing for a few hours together. My wife, who is a diehard Cyclone fan, is as invested as any of us. I have two daughters who, for the first time in their lives, have a female athlete that is a true role model for them. This whole experience has been so cool for me as a dad. The Iowa team has connected all of us together. Another fan who attended the win versus Colorado and LSU in Albany weighed in after the flight home. It was number one for me, beating LSU in that spot with the enormous TV audience and in front of a crowd that Iowa women's basketball built, he said. We met families from Queens, Manhattan, and other parts of Long Island. The response we received from them was, "Hawks all the way." We were floored by the reach this program has. A woman who was 11 years old when attending the 1985 Iowa-Michigan game said she probably blew a vocal cord that day in Kinnick Stadium, but felt like the Hawkeye win over LSU served as a resounding moment in time. She gets compliments on her Clark number 22 jersey while living in Portland, Oregon. This means so much more as a society, she said. It feels like it is a tipping point for women's sports, and our women's basketball team is part of what is leading that charge. As a girl growing up with fewer options for organized sports, the growth in women's sports and the attention paid to this team and the love so many people have for this crew and their sustained success is unparalleled. A 54-year-old man discovered joy in watching the Iowa women's team during the era of 2020 Big Ten Player of the Year Kathleen Doyle and has loved watching them ever since. Monday night's game was number one for me, he said. This team is special, and the women are special. I also work security at Carver Hawkeye Arena, and these ladies are genuine, caring, and very respectful on and off the court. Monday night's game was a thing of beauty, a total team effort. They ran LSU off the court and put on a scoring clinic. I can't read enough about them. A 37-year-old man relayed how this team has delivered memories for life. It's number one. I have a 10-year-old daughter that isn't a sports fan. Where was she Monday night? He said, right next to me on the couch with my other three kids and wife, cheering for Kate, Gabby, Caitlin, Sid, and each other player by name. I'll never forget the moments this team has allowed me to spend with my family that normally has the boys in one room and the girls in the other. One person who once held the thrilling 2009 Iowa football season, which resulted in an Orange Bowl win in the highest spot, now has a replacement. The coaches laid the groundwork over the past two decades to create a culture where fans feel truly a part of something big, the fan said. We get to see their personalities and their humanity. The continuity and veteran roster lets us really know and love the players and their selfless embrace of each role. To see the sheer joy on their faces Monday night was like watching a friend have their dreams come true. The hope for another bigger win or two to come. There were dozens of detailed responses, too, about why other wins in Iowa history ranked higher, and there's no doubt to each person that certain wins have certain meanings, so there is no right answer. But another sentiment shared by about Monday's win over LSU for the women has become was because of what's still possible for the team. Iowa faces UConn at 8:30 p.m. Central Time Friday from Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. The game will be televised on ESPN, with the winner facing either South Carolina or North Carolina State in Sunday's NCAA championship game at 2 p.m. Central on ABC. One 54-year-old who grew up on an eastern Iowa farm has had his perspective changed by this Hawkeye women's team. Football has always been number one in my mind. Things like the 1985 Iowa-Michigan game, I remember like it was yesterday, the fan said. That said, because of what was riding on Monday night, it has to rank number one for me. Not only a chance to beat LSU, to go to the Final Four and play for a national championship, but I think Monday night showed that Iowa has a very legitimate chance to win a national championship. Another Hawkeye football first fan has a new favorite game. These Hawkeye women have edged my Tate to Holloway moment from the 2005 Capital One Bowl miracle finish, also versus LSU, down to second place, the fan said. So much holistic goodness with this team, staff, culture, goals, and dedication. They have written an everlasting story. Tate to Holloway was an exciting moment, but it's nowhere near the satisfaction and enjoyment brought via these women. One fan apologized for the lengthy reply, but in the end, I thought it was worthy to finish this column. He was a University of Iowa sophomore during the 1980 Final Four and attended a raucous welcome home rally at the old fieldhouse. The excitement was intense, but brief, he said. There were no expectations, so the state lost its mind until the opener against Louisville, where Ronnie re-injured his knee. Then depression settled in. The excitement for this season began at last year's championship final buzzer. It was contagious and epidemic, expanding across the whole country. 56,000 people, officially 55,646, jammed Kinnick for a game that didn't count. Caitlin and company sold out arenas across the country, and number 22 has taken on its own special significance. We've had celebrities showing up in Carver like it was a Lakers game. This has been beyond any Iowa story I can remember. It's a phenomenon, bigger than the first Ragbri, crazier than the 1981 Rose Bowl campaign, and it led up to Monday night's rematch with LSU. What a game. What a feeling. What a great group of players and coaches to be able to support. I'm proud to represent our university, our community, and our state Monday night. Yeah, it's number one. He then added, to be eclipsed by this weekend.
Let's hope. Go Hawks. And we'll move to page 3A of today's Des Moines Register. Headline, Child Care Center's license ordered revoked over claims of meth use. The provider allowed to operate pending appeal. A story that the Register is running, written by Clark Kaufman of Iowa Capital Dispatch. A central Iowa child care provider is challenging a license revocation that's based on alleged methamphetamine use in her home. Amanda Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-A-Y, of Des Moines, is taking the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services to court in an effort to have a judge overturn the department's decision that revoked her child care provider's license. The case originated with a September 2022 complaint to the Department of Human Services alleging that Lindsay, who operates Amanda's Child Care out of her home on Don Lee Court in Des Moines, was using methamphetamine while caring for children and that she was allowing others to use and sell meth in the house while children were present. State records indicate that on the same day the Department of Health and Human Services received the complaint, it sent investigators to Lindsay's home. Initially, the inspectors later alleged that Lindsay failed to come to the door, but did so after a phone call was made and someone on the premises was alerted to their presence. At the time, Lindsay was caring for a 7-month-old child. Inspectors alleged that during their visit, Lindsay refused to give them access to a safe where the complainant had alleged that drugs were being stored. According to the inspectors, Lindsay said she had lost the key and forgotten the combination. According to the inspectors, Lindsay allegedly told them her cousin, while not authorized to be in the house, had moved herself in and then refused to leave, although Lindsay would later deny telling investigators that. The inspectors alleged that the cousin's probation officer reported that Lindsay had contacted her for assistance in getting the cousin out of the house, and said the cousin had claimed that she and Lindsay had used meth in the house. The inspectors contacted the cousin, who allegedly told them Lindsay was sometimes absent from the house, leaving her, the cousin, with younger children to care for. Within days of the investigation being launched, DHHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, notified Lindsay that her license, technically referred to as a child care registration, was being revoked effective October 4, 2022. While appealing that decision, Lindsay, still providing child care, participated last July in a hearing that involved not only her license revocation, but 5 separate child abuse assessments related to the allegations of meth in the house. Feel a sneeze coming on. Hang on if I turn the mic off here for a second. Try not to sneeze in your ear. In a proposed decision upholding DHHS's efforts to revoke Lindsay's license, Administrative Law Judge Toby Gordon ruled in August that there was significant evidence to indicate that the cousin was in the house as an unauthorized household member or caregiver, and that is a violation of state regulations. The administrative law judge ruled that Lindsay had admitted that her cousin was in her home over a period of months in the winter and spring of 2022, and he noted that the parents of one child also reported seeing the cousin in the house from time to time. Gordon concluded that Lindsay had allowed an unauthorized person to reside in the house and provide unauthorized, unsupervised care for a child. In his ruling, Gordon stated that in light of those findings, it wasn't necessary for him to address DHHS's parallel child abuse findings that meth had been present in the house, creating a risk for any children there. He also noted that in 2020, Lindsay's self-described best friend, who was homeless and had moved into her house without permission until DHHS intervened. In light of that past situation, Gordon ruled, Lindsay was undoubtedly aware that a violation could put her daycare registration at risk. Gordon's proposed decision in the case was forwarded to DHHS Director Kelly Garcia. 7 months later, on March 8, Garcia adopted the findings and issued a final order revoking Lindsay's daycare license. That, in turn, led to Lindsay's court petition last week seeking judicial review of Garcia's decision. The state has yet to file a response to the petition. Lindsay said Tuesday of this week in an interview with the Register that she doesn't understand why DHHS is taking the word of a known drug user in revoking her license. She said, "I can't believe it has gotten to this point," adding that she has been providing daycare for families for 22 years. Because she's no longer a state-registered child care provider, she cannot accept children whose care is funded through government child care assistance programs. In addition, she said the number of private-paid children she can care for is now capped at 6. Previously, she said she cared for 8 to 12 children at a time, and so this, she said, has cut my income in half. State records indicate that prior to the case involving Lindsay's cousin, DHHS's annual inspections of Amanda's child care resulted in violations primarily related to safety provisions, such as the need for additional smoke detectors. On some occasions, Lindsay was reported to have taken an unusually long time to answer the door when state investigators arrived at the house.
Body found in Missouri in 1978, ID'd as missing Ottumwa girl. This is written by Jose Mendiola of the Des Moines Register. A body that was found in the Mississippi River more than four decades ago has been identified as a 15-year-old girl from Iowa. The Lincoln County Sheriff's Office in Missouri said on Tuesday that DNA evidence helped identify a body known as the Lincoln County Jane Doe as 15-year-old Helen Renee Grooms, who disappeared from Ottumwa in the year 1977. Grooms' body was found in the Mississippi River near Ellsbury, Missouri, in March of the year 1978. A medical examiner at the time believed the victim was a woman 30 to 40 years old. The cause of death was identified as a drowning, and there were no signs of trauma, according to a news release. There were not many clues to identify the victim except a cat's eye ring and a tattoo that appeared to be of a name on her left forearm. Police concluded that the victim had been dead for 4 months and classified her death as undetermined. The body was laid to rest at a local cemetery with a headstone marking her grave as Lincoln County Jane Doe. Her remains were exhumed in October 2023, and faculty and students from Southeast Missouri State University performed an analysis. They were able to determine she was actually younger than first believed. Students and faculty also performed bone and dental analysis and submitted DNA samples to a private lab called Othram, Inc. for forensic genome sequencing. The lab was able to build a genealogical profile, and Othram's genealogy team was able to generate new leads in the investigation. We are profoundly grateful to the teams at SEMO, Othram, and the Lincoln County Coroner's Office for their invaluable contributions, which proved to be instrumental in finally solving this decades-old mystery and bringing closure to a grieving family, Lincoln County Sheriff Rick Harrell said in the news release. The Lincoln County Coroner's Office was able to contact Kevin Grooms, Helen's brother, and make a match to the DNA sample, KSDK-TV reported. Grooms told KSDK-TV his sister went missing on her birthday in 1977 in her hometown of Ottumwa. "I'm just overwhelmed with joy that we found my sister and we were able to bring her home and know where she's at," Grooms said.
Report: police justified in fatal shooting of a man with autism. This story by Byong M. Byong of the Des Moines Register. Fort Dodge police officers were justified in using deadly force in an encounter with 24-year-old Tyler Stansberry in March, according to the Webster County Attorney announcement this week. A report released by Webster County Attorney Darren Driscoll and posted on the Fort Dodge Police Department Facebook page on Tuesday named three officers and one sergeant who were involved in the shooting. They are Nicholas Ruggles, Andrew Lane, Matthew English, and Matthew Webb. All officers have returned to full duty status after being on critical incident leave while the March 16th incident was investigated. The county attorney said the officers each reasonably believed that such force was necessary to defend himself or another from harm. Officer English shot and killed Stansberry, who had autism and schizophrenia, after he ran at officers while armed with a knife. Police originally were called to the home on a distress call. According to County Attorney Driscoll's report, quote, "the call indicated that Stansberry was exhibiting out-of-control behavior, including injuring a dog inside the residence. Officers also discovered that Mr. Stansberry had an active arrest warrant for a violation of probation relating to a conviction for domestic abuse. When Stansberry wouldn't come out of the house, officers began clearing the basement in which he was hiding." The report says Ruggles led the officers in the home with a taser and a shield. Officer English followed and was armed with his service pistol loaded with live ammunition. Next was Officer Lane, armed with a less lethal beanbag round loaded in a shotgun. Webb took up the rear. Once officers were in the home, Stansberry's screamed and Once officers are in the home, Stansberry screams and charges at them from a darkened room. The report says Ruggles then deploys his taser. Lane fires his less lethal beanbag round, and English fires two live rounds from his service pistol, striking Stansberry twice in the torso. After falling to the ground at the feet of the officers, Stansberry continued to resist before he was subdued. Driscoll said that he later died. Christine Stansberry, Tyler Stansberry's mother, told the Des Moines Register in March that their family did not know about the warrant, adding that it stemmed from a previous mental health episode in which the family did not want to press charges. The day of the shooting, Christine Stansberry was out running errands. She said, "By the time I got here, the cops and my younger son were standing outside my house. The police wouldn't let us inside the house." She said her son was having a schizophrenic episode when he was shot and that she hopes authorities will be trained in dealing with mental health issues.
Thank you, Dave. One last local story on page 4A of the Des Moines Register. Iowa pays $50,000 to blogger in settlement of press pass suit. This is written by Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. Iowa state officials agreed Tuesday to pay attorney's fees and change state house policies to settle a lawsuit from a liberal blogger who was denied a press pass for coverage of the legislature. The three-member state appeals board voted unanimously to approve a settlement agreement with Laura Bellin, who has operated the Bleeding Heartland political blog for 17 years. Bellin sued Megan Nelson, chief clerk of the Republican-run Iowa House of Representatives, after Nelson denied her request for a press pass at the start of the legislative session in January. The pass gives journalists access to desks on the House floor. According to Bellin's lawsuit, Nelson did not provide a reason for her denial this year. But after Bellin sued, Nelson gave Bellin a press pass on January the 23rd and changed the House policy on qualifications for a credential, eliminating a requirement that journalists be nonpartisan. As part of the settlement approved Tuesday, the state will pay $49,000 to Bellin's attorneys at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Free Speech. Bellin agreed to dismiss the lawsuit, and Nelson agreed to keep the nonpartisan requirement out of the House press credential policy. Nelson also agreed that if she denies future press credential applications, she will cite the specific element of the policy that she believes applies. Bellin did not respond to a message seeking comment Tuesday. In a January 19th blog post explaining the lawsuit, she wrote that Iowa clerks had arbitrarily applied an ever-shifting credentialing system to deny Bellin's press pass requests since the year 2019. Bellin wrote that then-Chief Clerk Carmine Bowl, in her 2019 decision to deny Bellin's request for a press pass, said the blogger was not a member of the media. The Iowa Freedom of Information Council wrote a letter objecting to the decision, and the Institute for Free Speech wrote a legal brief arguing that the denial was illegal. In 2020, Bellin said Nelson denied her request because Bleeding Heartland is non-traditional media. Bellin said Nelson did not cite a specific reason for denying her press pass request the last 3 years. In the complaint, Bellin's attorneys alleged that Nelson violated Bellin's First Amendment rights and discriminated against her based on her viewpoints. In a January 24th blog post, Bellin wrote that Nelson had reversed her decision, granting her a press pass and reserving a spot for her in the journalist's workspace on the House floor. Bellin acknowledged that though her reporting was often unsympathetic to the GOP House, Senate, and governor, until 5 years ago, I never thought House leaders would deny I am a journalist who extensively covers legislative happenings. I knew some GOP lawmakers and legislative staff regularly read my work. Even though they usually disagreed with my conclusions, they respected my commitment to research, accuracy, and transparency. Institute for Free Speech attorneys Courtney Corbello and Charles Chip Miller represented Bellin in the case. "We are thrilled that we were able to reach this outcome for Laura and to have done so quickly," Corbello said in an emailed statement. The settlement provides permanent policy changes that will lead to greater transparency and consistency in the chief clerk's press credential policy. This is a win for press freedom and the public's right to be informed about the work of their elected representatives. Liberal political bloggers Drew Miller and Chris Woods started Bleeding Heartland in June of the year 2007, and Bellin joined the site soon after, posting under the name Des Moines Dem. Among other posts that have garnered attention around the state, Bellin wrote about Governor Kim Reynolds missing the deadline for a judicial appointment and her use of federal coronavirus relief funds to pay staff salaries in 2020.
Three stories on the front page of the Metro and Iowa section on this Friday, the 5th of April. Across the left-hand side, the lawsuit seeks to block demolition of artwork. Down the right-hand column, bill could help scout sex abuse survivors. And on the bottom, abuse and sex harassment by patrons are rampant in Des Moines libraries, according to a lawsuit filed by one staffer. Let's start with that story. This story is by William Morris of the Register, and it starts with an editor's note. This article describes allegations of sexually explicit conduct. Jennifer Golden, G-O-U-L-D-E-N, couldn't see the man's hands, but said that he was clearly touching himself inappropriately. The patron at Des Moines Public Library's Northside branch, where Golden worked as a librarian, had already disturbed staff members that evening by leering at teenage girls from behind a pillar. Now he was sitting at one of the computer terminals just feet away from a child at another computer with his belt unbuckled and only a jacket resting over his hips and hands. Perceiving him to be masturbating, Golden remotely ended the man's computer session. In response, he turned and continued touching himself while staring at her. He refused several instructions to stop and left only when warned that police had been called. The officers, when they arrived, refused to do anything despite being given his address and description because they had not personally seen what the man was doing. The next day, the man returned and again began masturbating while staring at Golden. This time, the staff contacted police at once but had to wait more than an hour for them to arrive while the man continued his misbehavior. This time, police kicked the man out and issued a trespass notice to keep him out of the Northside Library. Although not the library system as a whole, they declined to arrest him and because they said he had not committed any crimes. This episode from August of 2022 and other examples of violent, threatening, and indecent conduct by library patrons are among the allegations in a lawsuit Golden filed in March against the city and library system. She alleges the Des Moines Public Library's policies, procedures, and staff training are wholly inadequate to address inappropriate behavior by patrons, and that library leaders brushed off staff concerns and retaliated against employees who spoke up about the troubled workplace. Golden spent 18 years working in libraries, joining Des Moines' system in 2020. She left in 2023 and now works in publisher sales, a career shift that her attorney says was directly related to the rampant harassment she endured. In a statement, she said it was devastating to have to give up the only career she'd ever wanted in order to protect her mental health and physical safety. Golden said, "I deserved a workplace where I could safely do my job without being traumatized by patrons, and so does everyone else currently working for the library. Libraries," she said, "truly are a place for everyone to access the information and services they need to enrich their lives. But in order for libraries to fulfill their missions, library workers have to be safe." A spokesperson for the city said it plans to vigorously defend the lawsuit and referred questions about library policies to the library board. In a brief statement, Des Moines Public Library spokesman Tim Paluk referred a reporter with questions about the lawsuit's allegations to the library's customer behavior policy, which is intended to protect staff and the public. He said, "We take the safety of both very seriously." The August 2022 incident isn't the only instance of indecent behavior Golden describes in her complaint. In November of 2021, she says one patron whose jacket sleeve was empty sat across from her desk, asked invasive questions, and refused to end the conversation until a coworker invented a task to give her an excuse to disengage. She later realized, reviewing surveillance footage, that the man's arm had been inside his jacket and in his pants the entire time he'd been speaking with her. After finding a man masturbating to pornography in January of 2023, Golden told him to leave and filed a report, including screenshots from security footage. She alleges that senior library officials concluded her report was not precise enough and classified the incident as inappropriate internet use rather than sexual harassment. She alleges that Library Deputy Director Jan Hobbs told her that she was overreacting and sarcastically asked if she was traumatized. In another instance, in April of 2022, Golden says she had to block a domestic abuser with her body to give time for a coworker to help the man's partner escape the building. In May of 2022, she alleges a man in the library made threats against people he felt had wronged him, including other library patrons, and used library computers to look up addresses of his intended victims while graphically describing his plans to violently beat them. On the day after the mass shooting at a school in Uvalde, Texas, the man told Golden that he planned to bomb a Trader Joe's store, leading library staff to direct other patrons to leave the building. Police reportedly told her the man was harmless and refused to take any action, she says. In November 2022, a man followed Golden around the library, asked her out, and when she declined, loudly threatened and told her to shut her effing mouth or you're going to have to call the cops. A library security guard later described the man as complimenting and trying to connect with her, which she complained downplayed the seriousness of his threats. In each case, Golden says she completed incident reports for her supervisors, who took no remedial action. Even after library director Sue Woody sent an email to staff in fall of 2022 acknowledging what Golden calls a nearly constant stream of masturbating patrons, she says the library took no action to protect employees. She says in her legal complaint, defendants' expectations were clear. Staff must tolerate patrons' abusive behavior, sexual harassment, and threats of violence as a condition of employment. Unlike other libraries where Golden has worked, Des Moines lacked effective policies and procedures to address patron misconduct, she says, writing in the complaint that she was shocked by the inadequacy of the library's training and procedures for addressing patron misconduct. At past jobs, for example, Golden says she had the authority to ban patrons and get trespass notices delivered by police. In Des Moines, she says she could do neither. Lacking such tools, she says staff were left to develop informal tactics, such as calling each other's desk phones to help colleagues escape uncomfortable or harassing conversations. In some ways, Golden says, the Des Moines Public Library procedures got even worse during her tenure. While staff previously could view incident reports filed from other library branches, in January of 2023, they were limited to only seeing reports filed from their own branch. Before leaving her job, Golden made numerous suggestions to improve the library's safety protocols, according to her attorney, Madison Fiedler Carlson. Those include making doors to employee areas accessible only by badge, upgrading cameras, letting staff share incident reports between branches, pursuing criminal charges and trespass orders against patrons who engage in sex acts, and ensuring security alarms would trigger a police response. She wrote in March of 2023 in a letter, "At present, when the North Side security alarms go off, we get a letter in the mail days later alerting us. This is in no way useful or helpful. Help needs to come when it's called," she said. In her petition, Golden also points the finger at senior leaders, including Woody and Hobbs, for the staff safety woes. Woody reportedly described employee reports of patron violence as negativity or complaining, and in one case accidentally hit reply all on an email to Hobbs, telling him to consider the source of staff complaints and encouraging him to ignore them. Golden has Well, I'm not going to be able to say this right. Prosopagnosia, a very long word, also known as face blindness, according to her complaint, and feared that she was particularly vulnerable to repeat harassers because she's unable to recognize people by looking at them. She says the library failed to provide any accommodations to address this danger. She also accuses library leaders of retaliating against staff who raised complaints. After an employee emailed coworkers in the spring of 2020, raising concerns about racial harassment and discrimination in the workplace, the library responded by limiting employees' ability to email workers at other library branches, a change Woody reportedly said was made to stop staff from overreacting. This restriction made it harder for staff to communicate with colleagues at other branches about known harassers, Golden says. She also alleges she faced retaliation directly, when, after filing an internal complaint, she was banned from viewing the library's public Facebook page. She had never commented or posted on the page, she says, but remained blocked for more than 6 months. The Des Moines Library's customer behavior policy appears to cover much of the conduct described in Golden's complaint. It includes forbidding sexual activity of any kind or indecent exposure, harassing other patrons or staff, including physical, sexual, verbal, or stalking, as well as using or threatening to use weapons or viewing sexually explicit internet content. That language is in the current policy adopted in November of 2023, as well as a prior version adopted in December of 2022 during Golden's time at the library. Via Carlson, Golden pointed to Altoona and Urbandale as library systems where she worked that had more effective policies regarding patron sexual harassment. A review of those libraries' policies shows language similar to Des Moines policies. Altoona bans the use of abusive or obscene language or gestures toward patrons or staff, and excessive displays of affection, which includes sexual conduct or physical contact. Urbandale's policy forbids lewd or inappropriate behavior, and more broadly, behavior that threatens the health or safety of others. Urbandale's policy forbids lewd or inappropriate behavior, and more broadly, behavior that threatens the health or safety of others or interferes with employees or their patrons. But Carlson said that while Des Moines' policy may have language similar to or even stronger than those of nearby peers, the bigger issue than Altoona and Urbandale is that they consistently implemented their rules and applied consequences, while in Des Moines, she says, they did not. She says, in practice, harassing patrons at Des Moines Public Library got multiple chances to offend, figuratively and literally, library staff because reports were not taken seriously by administration.
Thanks, Dave. We've just got a few minutes before we reach the top of the hour, so I'll read some short articles from our 50 states page. And the highlighted one comes from California, Ojai, California. Four of the 36 baby owls arrived at a raptor hospital after venturing out of a Simi Valley nesting box too early. Another baby was found not moving in a backyard. Many of the newborn and toddler owls were blown out of their nests by the Santa Ana winds that gusted at 65 miles per hour in March. They ended up in the care ward of the 24-year-old Ojai Raptor Center, treated for fractures and fed mice by caretakers and volunteers who speak only in whispers and wear camouflage covering their bodies and faces. It is spring, a time of year summed up by the sign on a door of the nonprofit wildlife rehab site, Baby on Board, it says. And from Pennsylvania, York, Pennsylvania, the York County SPCA is in full-on crisis mode. Communications Director Kristen Dempwolf said as the shelter in Manchester Township has had an unprecedented intake of stray dogs. Last year saw a 34% increase in stray canine intake at the shelter from 2022, and the trend is only getting worse. Dempwolf said in March 2024, 101 dogs have been taken in so far, compared to 88 in March of 2023. And from Wakefield, Rhode Island, the Atlantic Shark Institute of Wakefield said it recently achieved a significant milestone in tagging its 30th great white shark as it researches shark movement and behavior.